So good evening, everybody. Good to see you all. And welcome to those who are here for the first time. And welcome back to everybody else. This is week two of Dharma Seminar series that I'm calling Difference and Unity, Encountering Injustice on the Bodhisattva Path. And as I said in my introduction last week, which is on the website if anybody likes to listen to podcasts. As I said last week, you know, it seems like there's just so much suffering in our world arising from the way we humans perceive difference as threat, the way we divide self and all we identify with as self, as me and mine, from, or me and mine, us and ours, from you and yours, they and them, the others. And how we use these perceptions of difference to validate not only harmful individual behaviors, but political and social structures that are harmful and unjust. And those differences can be based on so many things, right? Gender, sexuality, race, class, ability, age, appearance, not to mention species. You know, how we treat other species. So we're exploring Buddhist perspectives and practices that can support us to see clearly the roots of this suffering that is caused by perceiving difference as threat. And practices that can support us to respond with open hearts and minds. So it'll help us to keep in mind the Buddhist teaching that I mentioned last week of the two truths. The truth of difference, particularity, relativity, and the truth of unity, oneness, the absolute. Those are all words that are used for these two truths, which are not actually two. They're simultaneous and interpenetrating. And our practice is to live in awareness of both, always. Some of you, I'm sure, have heard of Angel Kyodo Williams. She's a Zen teacher, American, African-American, lesbian, activist, who's written a book called Radical Dharma, Talking Race, Love, and Liberation. So I want to share her words with you. Love and justice are not two. Without inner change, there can be no outer change. Without collective change, no change matters. So I think there have been times that Buddhist practice has been criticized for being focused, criticized and, on the other hand, defended for being focused on, you know, the inner, the individual transformation. But how can we really say that when the whole realization of our practice is that we are not isolated, separate individuals? That we always are in connection and relationship to the world around us and others. So tonight, for the coming weeks, I'm going to talk more specifically about different areas. And tonight, I thought I'd tackle gender, because, of course, as we all know, it's been a hot button topic in recent months. Sort of like, so what else is new? And because it's the oldest of our differences, it goes back to the first single-celled organisms that began reproducing sexually by recombining genes from two parent cells. I mean, that's really old. Followed, of course, by multi-celled organisms evolving specialized gendered egg and sperm cells to carry those genes. And then the incredible, just and bizarrely varied ways that organisms have evolved to reproduce in the most unimaginable ways. If you've ever read, about... I kind of wanted to bring you some examples. maybe I will someday. I have a couple of great books about sex in the animal world. But from that beginning, through the unbelievable array of gender and sexual strategies of plants and animals, all the way to our human configuration. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. Remember that book? Some of you probably don't. It's old. Well, now it seems old. 1990s, actually. Got a guy named John Gray, who was a man of questionable credentials. But it was a big bestseller. And I confess I never read it. I resist bestsellers. But I did read enough articles about it, quotes from it. And the differences that Gray proclaimed is inherent in men and women. So many of them were clearly subject to social and cultural conditioning, and also I don't think he read much anthropology because there's tremendous variation in human cultures and through history, as well as variation within individuals within any gender. I mean, this is something that's probably going to be argued about as long as they're human beings, what's innate and what's learned. But most of the research seems to agree that on almost all indicators, there's more variation within a gender than between the genders. Anyway, thanks to ultrasound technology, we can start the conditioning even before birth. Have you ever heard of a kind of baby shower called a gender party? I hadn't, but I learned about it from a story by Ivan Coyote. I'm sure some of you know the name. In their book called Tomboy Survival Guide. Highly recommended. So a gender party is... I should say, Ivan Coyote, for those who don't know, is an amazing writer and storyteller who identifies as transgender and who has done wonderful work advocating and educating for justice and understanding of difference around gender and sexuality. He goes around to schools all over BC and beyond. On their website, there's a kind of little... kind of podcast journal of those travels. Anyway, the gender party in question was held in Whitehorse, Yukon, where Ivan Coyote grew up, and it was in honor of their cousin's wife's pregnancy. At a gender party, at this kind of gender party, an iced cake is served, and when you cut into the cake, you see the color. The food dye in the cake reveals the gender of the child. And you guessed it, pink is for girls and blue is for boys. Ick. I mean, that's... I don't like that kind of cake. but in a delightful twist to the story, the baby girl born some months later turned out to be unusually precocious in her ability to sit, stand, and crawl upstairs, and acquired the nickname of Baby Strong. That's what they called her. But, you sometimes hear people talking about a little two-year-old boy who just loves everything to do with trains or trucks. And they'll say, oh, look at that. It's got to be innate. Right? Or a little girl just loves pink frilly princess dresses, and they'll say, oh, look at that. It's got to be innate. And it always makes me feel sad. It always makes me feel so sad, because I think, what about the little boy who loves to dress up in frilly things, and the little girl who loves trucks. No one says, oh, look at that, it's got to be an 8, do they? When I was a little girl, I wasn't into frills or trucks. I liked animals and trees, being outdoors, and tracking up little creeks to find the source, to find out where the little creek started. Learning to walk quietly with eyes and ears open. Where did that leave me? I knew I was a girl, wasn't interested in being a boy, but I was different, I felt different. And I certainly didn't feel very well qualified for womanhood when that came along. Humans are arguably the most adaptable species on Earth. And as I said, gender roles and relationships have varied through time and space much more than the Venus and Mars stereotype would admit. And we are continuing to evolve. We're struggling to adapt to the rapid changes of post-industrial society and electronic communication media. Long ago, in 1958, the science fiction novelist Ursula Le Guin published a book called The Left Hand of Darkness. Anybody old enough to remember that book? Yeah, look a few. In which humans were androgynous, or maybe that's not quite the right word. They both, males and females, well, they weren't males and females, but they could activate male or female biological capacities once a month. So that they could take turns having babies and reproducing. Can you imagine the profound effect this would have on human culture and society? Well, that was what she called her thought experiment. That's what she tried to imagine, and she imagined that there would be less warfare and sexual aggression if that were so. At the time, there were feminists who critiqued her for not going far enough. But she was quite daring, really, for her time, in 1958. We're a long way from being able to switch our biological gender like certain fish, or everyone being able to both father and mother like slugs, actually. Did you know that? Slugs have both male and female organs and can both reproduce, and they can mate with each other at the same time. Slugs. We can't do that, but in our postmodern times, we are recognizing that gender roles and identities and also sexualities are not binary, male and female, but exist on a spectrum, and that there's a lot more movement and crisscrossing and middle ground along that spectrum than the received doctrines of earlier generations would have us believe. This is not a new reality. It's always been so. Just an evolving recognition and understanding and acceptance, slowly. That gender doesn't always align with biology, that sexuality doesn't always align with gender or biology. There's plenty of historical, anthropological, and sociological research available if you want to learn more about gender and sexuality through history and in various cultures. And there are plenty of historical and first-person accounts of the suffering caused by cruelty and injustice based on gender difference. Well, we don't really have to look any further than the daily news. When we look at Buddhism and Zen, we see that both have come to us through via cultures as deeply patriarchal as any in the West, with a long history of discrimination and injustice towards women. And non-conforming individuals. Though there's probably little record of that. In early Buddhism, it was believed that women could not attain enlightenment without first being reborn into a man's body. That women were hampered by the nature of their embodiment. That women were unable to govern their desires. However, from the beginning, there have been strong awakened women in Buddhist literature and stories that affirm women's capacity for enlightenment. So I want to share with you a few of my favorites. The first is how women came to be accepted. Some of you, I'm sure, know this story. How women came to be accepted into the Buddha's community, the historical Buddha. The story goes that the first woman to ask to be ordained into the Sangha was Mahaprajapati, who was his aunt and foster mother who raised him after his own mother died when he was about 10 days old, the story goes. And when she asked him, he replied, "Do not set your heart on this." She asked him two more times, and still he refused. Finally, she came back with 500 other women who wanted to be ordained. They shaved their heads, they put on monk's robes, and walked barefoot for days to reach the place where the Buddha was teaching. And this time, Mahaprajapati appealed to the Buddha's attendant, Ananda, for help. So Ananda went to the Buddha and said, "Your aunt and 500 women are outside begging to be admitted to the Sangha. It would be good if you could accept them." And the Buddha said, "Do not set your heart on it." Then Ananda asked, "Are women able to realize the full fruits of the way?" "Yes, Ananda, they are," said the Buddha. "Then how can you turn away the woman who raised you as her own son?" And the Buddha finally relented and ordained the women into the Sangha. I heard this story, I think, for the first time years ago at San Francisco Zen Center from one of the women teachers there, who is herself lesbian, and she said, "I think Ananda was gay and he was being a really good ally." But the Buddha put conditions on. He added an additional 8 precepts or rules. Well, okay. Actually, a lot of scholars believe that it wasn't the Buddha who did that. That actually came later as the Sangha grew and became more institutionalized. So it's not clear that the Buddha added those extra 8 rules. And those extra 8 rules, which I don't have right here to give you, but they're all about kind of restricting women's autonomy, mobility, and have often been justified as protecting the women from the men's lust and and protecting the men from temptation. So, 2.5 millennia later, we still hear that the way to protect women from sexual aggression from men is to restrict women's freedom of movement and expression. So, things change and don't change. The Mahayana Buddhist tradition, which emerged several hundred years after the Buddha's lifetime, opened up the possibility of awakening for men and women and equally, and for ordinary people as well as monastics. It was a movement that kind of away from what had become a kind of institutionalized and very very scholastic version of Buddhist practice. And in one of the early texts, the Lotus Sutra, there's a story about the Naga princess, or Nagas are sort of like dragons. And in the story, Manjushri, who's the Bodhisattva of wisdom, travels to the undersea palace of the Naga king and comes back to the Buddha amongst an assembly of Bodhisattvas, rather like this, only there were countless numbers of them. And Manjushri praised the 8-year-old Naga princess, saying she loves all beings as herself and is capable of realizing the enlightenment of the Buddhas. And one of the Bodhisattvas said, "The Buddha himself spent thousands of lifetimes to practice before enlightenment. How could an 8-year-old girl realize enlightenment?" And at that, the princess herself appeared amongst them. And she presented the Buddha with a precious jewel, which he immediately accepted. Then she said, "The jewel I gave to the Lord Buddha was quickly accepted, was it not?" And they all nodded. She said, "Then now I will attain Buddhahood even more quickly." So she transformed instantly into a male bodhisattva, carried out all the practices of a bodhisattva, sat down beneath a bodhi tree, and was completely enlightened, and began to teach the Dharma to beings throughout the universe. Quite impressive. But she still had to transform into a male bodhisattva first. A few hundred years later, in the Vimalakirti Sutra, there's another story that consists of conversations between the legendary enlightened layman Vimalakirti and another assembly of bodhisattvas and disciples of the Buddha. And in the midst of one of these conversations, a goddess appears and strews flowers all over the assembly. That story I'm going to come back to next week. But now I want to mention an exchange between the goddess and the Buddha's disciple, Shariputra. Shariputra is always the fall guy in these stories. He challenges the goddess and says, "Well, why don't you transform yourself out of that female body into a man?" She says, "If a sorcerer were to conjure up a phantom woman and someone asked her why she didn't change out of her female body, would that be a reasonable question?" Shariputra thought about it. He said, "No, phantoms have no fixed form, so what would there be to change?" "That's right," said the goddess. "All things are like that, with no fixed form. So why ask me why I don't change out of my female body?" And then she transformed Shariputra into a goddess, and herself into Shariputra. Shariputra said, "Oh, why have I suddenly taken on the form of a woman's body?" And the goddess explained, "All phenomena appear and disappear. All phenomena are ultimately not male or female." Then she turned him back into Shariputra and herself into a goddess again, and said, "Shariputra, where now is the shape and form of your female body?" He said, "The form and shape of my female body does not exist, yet it does not not exist." She said, "All phenomena are like that. They do not exist, and they do not not exist." Another 1,000 years later, Dogen Zenji, who brought our tradition Zen practice from China to Japan, was unequivocal. He said, "What are the inherent faults of women, and what are the inherent virtues of men? There are unwholesome men, and there are unwholesome women. Hearing the Dharma does not depend on being female or male. Before becoming free from delusion, men and women are equally not free from delusion. At the time of being free of delusion, there is no difference between men and women." And indeed, in this, in our tradition, men and women, monks and lay people, all take the same set of 16 bodhisattva precepts. There are no separation. So all that said, we still have to acknowledge that throughout Buddhist history and each Buddhist culture, communities of nuns, women practitioners, have experienced great discrimination and received less support and even died out. less support than monastic establishments. And even to this day, that perspective of the absolute, of no differentiation, you know, no male, no female, no gender difference, that perspective can be used as a kind of smokescreen to obscure and dismiss the reality of pain caused by exclusion based on difference. Grace Shearson, American Zen teacher, wrote a book called Zen Women. She tells the story of an unnamed male Zen teacher who came back from an early conference of American Zen teachers who were virtually all male, and came back to his own sangha and was asked by the women in his sangha how many women teachers were present at the conference. He replied, "We were all women." And she writes that at the time, the women kind of looked at each other uncomfortably, but weren't really able to challenge him. But from her later vantage point, she came up with the perfect comeback. "How many of you women teachers used the ladies' room at the conference?" She said, "It took 20 of my more than 40 years of Zen practice to go beyond being intimidated by the oneness thing." So on the other hand, right, of, you know, we're all one, there's no difference or no separation. Denying difference, denying differential treatment, invoking non-discrimination, saying, "I don't see gender," or "I don't see color," is a way of refusing to see the lived experience of the person right in front of you and fully meeting them, as we'll see when we talk about race in a couple of weeks. So we need to be able to hold both truths simultaneously, the truth of difference and the truth of unity. We need to be able to open our eyes and our ears and our hearts to those we perceive as different from us, and to be scrupulously honest with ourselves when we feel a sense of pushing away or fear or threat. We need to be interested in the mind, our mind, and in others' lives, lived experience. We need to be each other's teachers. So as I mentioned earlier, I've been listening to the life stories of Ivan Coyote. Actually reading, but it feels like listening, because they're such a good storyteller. And I'd like to nominate them as the Trance Bodhisattva of the Year for their big, big heart, full of compassion for self and other. Really, yeah. They co-wrote this book called Gender Failure with a fellow trance musician and writer Ray Spoon. Ray Spoon grew up in Calgary, and Ivan Coyote grew up in Whitehorse. And both in the book track their struggles and sorrows and joys of sorting out the issues of gender and sexuality and growing up in hostile environments, and what it was like to be different. With a great deal of honesty and humor. And so I just want to read first. This is Ray Spoon, who was assigned a female gender at birth, and after serial comings out as a lesbian, a transgender man oriented sexually to women, and a transgender man oriented sexually to men, each time fraught with pain and confusion and rejection. Who finally decided to quote, retire from the gender binary. So this is, oops, wrong one. After all that has changed for me, I'm more inclined to leave the narrative open for myself than I have in the past. Now that I define my gender and sexuality as stories I tell and agree upon, I want to leave room for future possibilities that I have not been presented with yet. I am a gender failure. I failed at the gender binary, unable to find a place in being either a man or a woman with which I felt comfortable. But ultimately, I believe that it's the binary that fails to leave room for most people to write their own gender stories. So that they alternate chapters. And here's Ivan Coyote's words. Sometimes it exhausts me, all the head shaking and stumbling around to navigate and negotiate the two-ring circus that is this gender binary. Walking pronoun tightropes and balancing between my safety and someone else's comfort. You are free to call me trans, and I am proud to lift this name up and hold it right there in the sun, and you would not be wrong. But this still feels like I'm borrowing a word from someone else, that it is not all the way mine, really, and my friend who lent it to me might need it back, or they might need it more than me. And really, these are just words, and words are always imperfect. Words are just sounds we make up with our mouths that point our minds to think of things that cannot be fully described in words anyway. I think she's secretly a Zen person. I am a writer. She, he, they. They use all three. She, in another part, so it's easy to... Ivan does. Ray doesn't. So it's, you know, you have to listen to the person. But I'm a writer, so I know where words fail us. A name is not a person. It is just what we have agreed to call them. So we do our best. We do our best to listen and agree and respect. Often those who are different from social norms, who have suffered greatly from discrimination and outright persecution, have been shut out from their own families or from the family of humanity, they have something to teach us about ourselves, our own feelings of otherness, and the way we shut others out of our hearts. They can teach us compassion if we listen deeply. Listening is the key. Then, from that place, we can speak and act or keep our mouths shut with both wisdom and compassion in the face of injustice. This is the path of the Bodhisattva, I think. So, let's see. I have some... thank you for listening, and I have some reflection questions to invite you to engage with. And could we quickly pass out pens and paper, and while we do so, could someone else help with the passing out pens and pass paper? Just grab and pass. Could we the whole stack. Bring the whole stack. And pass. Here. Michael, could you help circulate that? If we were doing this as a workshop where people registered ahead and everybody said, yes, I'm in for this, and we had more time, we'd go into more depth and we'd make time for people to share in more depth. But... given that that's not the case, and that we're just getting our feet wet in these areas, we want to make it safe for people to do some reflection, some self-reflection, and a little bit of sharing as people feel comfortable to do. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to ask you a couple questions, and you're just going to make some notes for yourself. This is not for anyone but yourself. And then we'll make a couple of circles, and we'll just briefly give people an opportunity to share a reflection, if they wish. Okay, so first question is, what messages about gender did you receive growing up in your family or culture? This does not have to be an essay form, just make a list. What messages about gender did you receive growing up in your family and or culture?
Mm-hmm.
Does everybody have something to write with? Oh, there might be a few more. There's a basket, still has some. And if you want to just do this in your head, that's fine too. You don't have to write it, but sometimes writing is helpful. So take a few minutes with that, just a few. Okay, the second question, and you can do this kind of as you go even, is what ways have you felt like a gender failure? Unable to conform to the norms and expectations that you've received. Not able to be masculine or feminine enough. In what way? Keep in mind that even individuals who are like hyper-masculine, hyper-feminine, I mean, consider Marilyn Monroe, suffered greatly. The constrictions of being seen that way. And then ultimately, there's no way to escape gender failure when you get old. By certain standards. Okay, I'm going to stop you even though you're still going. And I would suggest, if this is something you really want to explore, this series of reflections, you know, keep a little journal and you know, do some writing for yourself at home. Okay, so what I would like us to do now is move our seats into two circles. One circle on that side of the room, one circle on this side of the room. So just kind of quick move your seats into kind of a circle.
Circle on this side.
Okay, maybe on that side, kind of turn that way. And then we'll even them out once we're in. Hopefully it will be approximately even numbers.
I have to think that I'm no longer contagious, therefore I allow myself to be in public.
Okay. So once we're in, could you come slide over here so we're circular? Okay, that's pretty good. I think we're, feels like a few, maybe a little bit more here on this side.
Maybe we should just go ahead though anyway, because it's...
Because of time. Okay. So what we're going to do is each person just briefly, and only if you feel, whatever you feel comfortable, just share something that, some observation or insight or something that surprised you or that you hadn't thought about, just something from that little exercise that you, just one short thing that you, and if you would rather just pass, please just, we do this, we bow and speak, and then when we're finished, bow again, and then everybody bows to thank you. And if you want to pass, you just say bow, say pass, you don't, you just say, and then one thing is that we agree that what people say in these circles, we don't bring up with them or anyone else afterwards, just so that there's a sense of holding with respect. So if one person in each group could just begin, and say your name first, please. Thank you. And then we'll just go around clockwise from that person who's brave enough to start us off. Okay? Go.
Jesse? I don't have anything to share to it and then say something?
Yeah, go ahead and start.
Hi, Jesse. What came up for me was... the question about family and culture. When I was growing up, I was kind of allowed to watch like R-rated films pretty early. Young, and we would watch stuff like American Pie, and just general like what are looked upon often as just like fun teen movies, but it's really
money, powers,
kind of disturbing just how intense the depiction of what it means to be a young man in college or high school and what it means to be a young woman is. And I think that I internalized that pretty early on, so it took a lot of work to shake that off. But those are like really popular and continue to be very popular.
The first one,
I'm Brian, and I'll pass.
Zakir. Just the constant struggle with allowing yourself to be, as someone who's in more of a traditional, also kind of masculine role, allow yourself to be taken care of is something that always comes up for me when I think about this. Because in many traditional situations or other situations, you're in a masculine role, you're the provider of some description.
Kate, and I'll pass.
I'm Kevin. I think, I don't know, what I realize is that so much messaging sort of is not, it's not clear where it came from. Trying to dig up these sort of memories from my childhood of being, having these gender, these ideas about gender roles enforced on me. I couldn't come up with any specific memory of receiving those stories, and yet...
All our names are gender.
There were so many memories of myself enacting these ideas that
my name is Yuri.
I know we're not
a
name. I
was born up in Japan, and the gender role is very clear. And my grandma used to call me I used to tell me that you cannot cross-legged,
Rich.
Sit cross-legged
and,
in front of others.
I found it interesting
and
for
now,
the
I can freely
gender failure
cross-legged here.
And the concept of age associated with gender failure. And what came up for me was, I don't actually have gender failure, but I certainly have physical failure. So, but I have, feel perfectly fine with my gender, it just doesn't always perform how I'd like it to. So I think I'll leave it at that.
This talk about genders and justice and all of that.
Michael?
At the same time,
something
the,
that just came to me now was some early memories in my childhood where
real issue. I personally think that the question of
the leader, the male leader of the household was very masculine, and I didn't quite fit that bill, but
so
I really enjoyed the activities,
I know that,
which were
the discussion
sort of very masculine activities, which
but personally, I haven't
didn't
had too much
create a
bit
very clear sort of like,
myself, like in my
dichotomy
life,
for myself, and
I'm
thinking back on those experiences.
Issues regarding that. At the same time that I have respect for that discussion.
Yeah, I just find it interesting.
That's why you really don't have much more to share.
Think about that period as more like a fog. There wasn't, you know, clear sort of difficulties.
Hi, I'm Susan.
But I just remember really enjoying hunting as a child, which comes as a real shock to people
as
when I
young,
tell them that
girl.
Being an artist.
I was
and,
battered by my
I also fell in love with cars,
because
which is also a shock for
quiet.
People in the creative community for some reason to really enjoy driving over cars.
Quiet.
And I still do.
So, I grew up
and I have
that is the first
regained also a desire
teaching.
To hunt again,
that,
fishing and so forth. And so
brought me to Buddhism.
I don't know why I'm really mentioning this. It just kind
it's
of
an interesting paradox.
Things weren't
that
so clear